Welcome back to the Petcash Pod presented by ProFluence Sports. I'm your host, Andrew Petcash. You can listen to all the other great conversations at profluence.com/podcasts or your favorite audio platform, Spotify, Apple, iHeartRadio, Google, and many others. We had a great conversation today with Ollie Raisin. He is the co-founder of F1 Arcade. They just opened their first location in Boston, all around these social entertainment, entertainment concepts. And Ollie is what many call a legend in the space. He's been doing it for a very long time. He's been a part of Putt Shack and Bounce Ping Pong and Hijingo and Wonderball and Games Gurus. So he knows what he's doing. It's super interesting to hear him break it all down. This world continues to get more popular, and he lays it out for us. So enjoy the conversation. Make sure to share them, and this is one you're probably going to want to do that. You're going to learn a lot. So anyway, let's dive right in.
Okay, so how far do you want me to go back? This is not something I did at college or anything like that. It wasn't something.
Yeah, I mean, just give us some high level data points. I know you were in comedy for a little. You had a untraditional journey, which is super cool, into what you're doing today, yeah. Which I would say are untraditional in the business aspect. They're new and they're taking off. But high level points, and then dive a little bit deeper into your experience in the social entertainment space.
Yeah, for sure. So I moved back to the UK in 2007. So I've been living back here for 17 years. Previously to that, I was in Australia for 17 years. And before that, I was in the UK for 10 years. In Australia, yeah, as you mentioned, I'd had a pretty decent career in comedy, which led to jobs doing, a big job doing commercial breakfast radio. And from commercial breakfast radio, that got me into depression. So after being sort of a bit miserable for a while, I left that job and moved back to the UK like 2 weeks later. No plans, just came back. And that was 2007. It was around 2010, so 3 years later, when I fortuitously and serendipitously found myself with a 3,000 square foot warehouse space to run and manage in Dalston, which is kind of at the time, the epicenter of London cool. So we had this big warehouse right on the canal. So we had like this really, really, really interesting sort of location. And in the warehouse, I started doing a lot of different kind of events and parties and all that kind of stuff. But one thing that I did, which was every single Friday night, was this event called the Whiff Waff Brothers. I think maybe in 2008 or something like that, the then mayor of London, who was Boris Johnson, who went on to become a terrible prime minister. He had done his sort of closing speech for the Beijing Olympics, saying the next one's in London. And then he talked about table tennis and he called it Whiff Waff. Whiff Waff's coming home, all this kind of nonsense that he likes to go into. So yeah, I was doing this thing called the Whiff Waff Brothers every Friday night. So nobody could hire it for raves or parties or whatever else. But this was like the first iteration into sort of social entertainment, competitive socializing, whatever you want to call it. We had three table tennis tables in the room, and we would open the space up to sort of the cool kids of East London every Friday night, 8 o'clock at night till 8 o'clock in the morning the next day. These were all night parties. After about 4 weeks of running those, I got a little bit bored and I wanted to have more say in what happened. So I built like sort of a DJ deck area, got bigger speakers, got a microphone, got a little slot for a bottle of whiskey so I could be sipping whiskey the whole time. And from there, we just created this really big kind of scene around ping pong and table tennis in East London. And I would just like, people would be there, maybe we'd have like 50 people or 150 people, whatever it was that week. And I would just create games around ping pong for all these people. Because pretty soon into doing this, I realized, if you make something for people who just love ping pong, then that's all you're going to get. You're going to get purists coming and they're going to, maybe they get hyper competitive and they're not going to drink. They're not going to want a party. So yeah, pretty soon into it, I was like, well, this needs to be more of a social kind of experience, more of just a movement and a happening rather than the sport of things. From doing the Whiff Waff Brothers, this is how I met up with Adam Breeden, who is the CEO of our company. And Adam is a tremendous entrepreneur in this space. His background, he started with kind of the first sort of high-end cocktail type pub. He then went into a concept called All Star Lanes, which was the real sort of precursor to social entertainment as we know it today, which was very basic at its basic heart. That was just bowling, but the food and drink were elevated just that level above what everybody else was used to. So I met up with him and his business partner, Dov, and this was in 2011. In 2012, we opened our first concept. They're obviously, I've always sort of been the sort of creative loose cannon and things like that. They're the entrepreneur. They were the entrepreneurs and stuff at the time. So 2012, we opened up Bounce Ping Pong, which was in Farringdon in London. If anyone knows that area, that is kind of like very much a corporate kind of area with a lot of lawyers, a lot of solicitors around there, a lot of human services, bankers, that kind of stuff. So we always make sure that we open in an area that has a pretty high level of a corporate business nearby. So Bounce really, really, really took off. And what I was doing there is I took my experience from the Whiff Whaff Brothers, which was this really anarchic kind of loose kind of anything goes games around ping pong that reward everybody who plays, not just the best people, and took that to smaller groups within the venue. And these became incredibly popular. And when Bounce opened, we were just so ridiculously busy because we really fulfilled a need in the market at the time. And that was sort of corporate entertainment that wasn't solely focused around drinking and getting drunk, because the old culture of sort of throw some money behind the bar and then watch your accounts team do things inappropriately with everybody else. It was just like there was too many lawsuits happening. So what we did was we offered like really lighthearted, fun, humor-led ping pong in a beautiful environment with high-end food and high-end drinks. That was the very first concept, Bounce Ping Pong 2012. I'll keep going from there if that helps you, just straight into it. So from there, that was like sort of a baptism of fire. It was the next 2 years were a bit of a blur because we were just so ridiculously busy, because at the time there wasn't really a business like ours in London. 2014 came around, and that's when sort of the first sort of peers started to pop up and rivals started to pop up. So in 2014, we had the first Flight Club Darts come about, which we actually sort of as a company gave them a bit of guidance in the early iterations. And then as a company as well, at the time, we took the US license for Flight Club. We also saw brands like Swingers coming up, which was a mini golf concept that I believe is now also moving to the States. And we built a second site as well in London. So our second site popped up in Shoreditch. So our first was in Farringdon, which is very much corporate hotspot. Second one, Shoreditch, which is very much like the really cool kind of area to go out. And so both of these venues had a really different vibe. Moving forward to 2016 is when we did our first US site. And that was called Ace Bounce, which we opened in Chicago. I spent most of 2016 in Chicago, just there really just to kind of get the culture of what we'd done in place, just to really imbue the fact that we're not about ping pong. We were about having a laugh and facilitating friendship groups to come and do something a bit different. And yeah, but in the meantime as well, 2016, maybe actually it's probably 2015, that's when we started concepting and working on Putt Shack, which was our first mini golf concept. And we had met the two twins who were responsible for Topgolf. So they came up with the trackable technology, they created Topgolf, and they were looking to do something in the mini golf world. So yeah, we met up with those guys. Started putting the concept together, realized that we didn't want to go down the really strict kind of golfing route. And again, we wanted to make sure it was really palatable for mass market participation and not just for golfers and things like that. So if people know what Putt Shack is, we took a computer and stuck it in a mini golf ball. So instead of like walking around with a pen and paper, it now does all of your scoring for you. And as it does all of your scoring for you, there's no need to mess around with a PAR system. You can create a completely new scoring system, which was designed to make sure that the people who were terrible at it still had a chance to win going into the second or last hole. Because what happens with any of these things is everybody sets off with good intentions in the first 5 minutes. And then once people realize that they can't do it, or they're embarrassed or whatever else, they just lose interest. And for me, that's just like, there's just no point opening something where people are going to lose interest. So yeah, kept on pushing through. Coming up to 2018 now, this is when we launched our first Putt Shack site. That was in West London, about 6 months to a year later. Can't remember when now, but we launched another two sites in the UK. Then we started to launch Putt Shacks all across the US. I think there might be, 15 to 20 of them now? It's quite a lot. But we always like to keep doing new things. So once we had launched Putt Shack, maybe a year later, we started, we actually started in 2018. We launched Putt Shack and then we were straight on to the next thing, which was a concept called Hijingo, which was a really high-tech bingo concept, almost like you're stepping into a spectacular game show. And so we spent 2018, 2019 just working with some really, really amazing designers and set designers and people. These are the people who like built the sets for Beyonce and Jay-Z and like did their world tours and things. So that kind of real massive spectacular scale condensed into a 8,000 square foot room playing bingo in a really, really fun and interesting way. So we were about to launch that. This takes us now to March 2020. We were in our launch week of Hijingo. We had just done our friends and family. We'd been testing out all the equipment. We'd been testing, about to do our very first VIP media party when a virus called COVID hit and we all entered into a lockdown. So all the work that we'd done, we had to shutter immediately. And yeah, that was a really strange time, as everyone will remember. But what it did allow us to do is Adam was then able to sort of go through some old emails that they'd had, because often we'll have people come to us with things like pitches or licensing deals or whatever else. But we've never really been in a position where we could just like, we've got a really nice little window where we can just have a look at something. But Adam had received an email from Formula One, and they had asked, would we be interested in pitching for a licensing concept, be that hospitality, whatever else, UK based, I think. And that was in like February 2020, and he had to say no. But then COVID happened, and sort of maybe at the very end, the very start of March, so roughly 4 years ago is when we first started working on it. So there's kind of like four of us who have worked together since 2012. So it's Adam Breeden, who's the CEO, Diane Jervis, who's the chief operating officer now and the global president, Janika Zadoro, and myself. So we'd always worked on these concepts together. So creating the whole concept and then putting projects into place and teams and all that kind of stuff. So we, the four of us, then jumped back onto some Zoom calls in the height of staying in and basically built out the concept for what is now F1 Arcade. At the time, I was the only one who'd done any sim racing. And I said to the guys, like, I have to be honest, sim racing is one of those things that you watch somebody do it and you're desperate to have a go. And then you sit in it and you get to the first corner and it sucks because you suck. It's not like arcade racing where it's just ready to go for you. So our very first thing was like, right, if we're going to do a concept for F1, first of all, whenever we do anything, we never do it for the people who love it. If you do it for them, those people, you shrink your audience immediately and you have to be so perfect. So what we always do is take the best elements of something, repackage them, repurpose them, reinvigorate them in order to give them back out to everybody else. So it was the same. It was the same with F1. Like F1 at the time was going through a little bit of a dodgy period because it was at the end of the sort of Bernie Eccleston era, and he'd done an amazing job to build the company to where it was, but it did have this sort of old power feel to it, where everything was kept hidden from the public. All you got to see were like the really premium. You never even really got to see the drivers' faces. And Formula E was really starting to take off as well. But then what kind of, it didn't necessarily change the fortunes of F1, but it brought in a brand new audience of 250 million people. And that was Drive to Survive. And Drive to Survive also let me know and let us know that F1 were open to exploring what is possible with their brand and with their concept. So yeah, we were able to put together a concept around F1. We didn't want to do an F1 fan zone. We didn't want to do a sim racing zone. We didn't make this for gamers. We made this for the vast majority of public who just love to go out with friends, family, work colleagues, have a few drinks, have some laughs, do an activity, and then go out and talk about it afterwards. So we put this whole concept together. We took it back to F1. They liked the idea so much that we pretty much got the contract straight away. And then we had to go away. And Adam says it's one of the hardest things he's ever had to do in his life, which is raise 18 to 20 million pounds over Zoom calls. Fundraising during a global pandemic was difficult. But we got there. And then, so I think, when did we open? Gosh, 2022? So about, I suppose, coming up to 3 years after talking about it, we opened the first site in St. Paul's in London. We opened the second site in Birmingham in November 2023. And this week, in 2 days actually, we open in Boston. And then after Boston, we move on to Washington, D.C. And then I don't know if it's been revealed yet, but we do have the next US site coming early 2025.
That's incredible, Ollie. And I love ones like this because I don't have to say too much and you basically unpack it all. And if people are listening, a bunch of questions or things would be in there and just summarizing five of the main things. And then I'll get to my question. But you talked about how important location is, that there, obviously your team is really good, improving, having higher end tech and food, and don't just target enthusiasts. You want interest to be pretty broad. Yeah. I'm curious now, we're seeing a lot of people try to enter the social and entertainment space, especially in sports. You hear it, edertainment. There's a bunch of different words, as we've talked about. Top Golf success, some of your success with some of the other ones are bringing a lot of people in. And what are some problems you're seeing, or where are people going to go wrong? What are some of the mistakes you might even be catching on to early? Because I'm sure a lot of people ask you even to be advisors or join their projects.
Yeah, for sure. It's hard to say that they're mistakes, because you can still have a relatively successful business just going down this route. But if you do stick too closely to the, let's say it's a sport, because we're often talking about sports and activities in this field. If you stick too closely to what that is, you limit yourself straight away, because what that is already exists, and it's already got its fans, it's already got its purists and stuff like that. And so if you go down that route, all you're doing is sort of recreating the wheel, and you're just slightly packaging up something differently, which will potentially titillate an audience for 18 months. But as soon as you've burnt through that group of fans, you have nothing to back it up. So I think the reason why Top Golf was so successful is because it's not golf. It's whacking a ball with a stick under the name of golf, but it's not. I mean, golf is this hyper purist thing where you have to be ridiculously accurate. The hole is tiny. It's all played on grass. Top Golf is targets. We've been to Top Golf and we've played with people who are like the worst in the world, but if they just hit it into like a big enough of the target thing, then they win. And that's the crucial thing. Like, and that should be like where people are starting with their concept. When if they've got a particular idea in mind, like they want to do basketball, for example, they have to think about like, what are the things that make it hard for the public to engage with basketball? What's a difficult thing about basketball? Okay. The first thing is like throwing the ball from a 3-point line. Okay. Why is it hard? Well, the ball's quite heavy. People aren't that strong. The accuracy is incredibly small. And then it's like, well, how do we change that? Is it, do we go bigger hoops? Do we go lighter balls? Do we do shorter lines? Do we do more points to be got? There's, you have to start thinking of it like that. Like, the action of the sport is one thing, but what are all the other things that you can hook onto it that will make it more interesting for everybody else?
And now when you look at locations, that seems to be potentially the most important thing of all. I know you talked about the corporate side and the other one's a high-end district in London when you're doing one of your first, I forget which one. What kind of research or what's the go-to-market look like to successfully go, okay, you're launching Boston now. What all goes into going, hey, here's a good location, here's a good city, here's, you know, X, Y, Z of why we're going here.
I mean, just quickly, the reason why we go down this particular path, and this is just because it's our business model, is that we have like a certain spend per square foot that we want to hit. And if we were going down the route of what might have been expected 10 or 15 years ago, that these businesses are essentially social businesses, then we're kind of relying on our Friday and Saturday and Sunday trade to do all of our work for us. Whereas the biggest kind of sweet spot is all the corporate trade Monday to Friday. That's your bread and butter. That's what makes a good business great. So it is not going to work for you if you're focused towards a corporate market to be positioned on the outskirts of town and require people from offices to travel 20, 30 minutes to get to you after work, because they just won't do it. You'll get a dropout rate of like, you might invite 100 people, 20 bother to show up. So it's just not going to work like that. So if you position one of these businesses where there are people working, so everything's walkable or a 5-minute bus or tube ride or even a taxi ride, then it's just, you've just got such a huge market to tap into within a 2 or 3 mile radius of you. Boston for us, I suppose instinctively we may have opened in Chicago first because we have a knowledge of that city. We've opened Ace Bounce there, Flight Club, and we've had like corporate offices and stuff there before. But we have opened in Boston and in Seaport a Putt Shack and a Flight Club, and they've both done really, really well. And it's more about us knowing that particular market and what's going to work, rather than us entering into sort of virgin territory first up, because our intention is very much US focused, and we want in the next sort of number of years to open 20, 30, 40, 50 sites across the US. So Boston is really just a territory that we understand, that we respect, that have liked the concepts that we've done before. Yeah, that's it. It's not necessarily a risk mitigation. It's just we're removing some risk by entering a territory where we already know a little bit about how these things can operate.
When you talked about raising the 18 to 20 over Zoom, we all know that's tough. I'm curious, what type of investors do these opportunities normally attract? Because it seems to fit in a weird gap in between private equity and venture capital. So doing many, has that changed or what does it even look like typically?
Yeah. I can't speak with loads of authority on this, but I have like a bit of a basic understanding on this. And pre-COVID, it was definitely heading more towards venture capitalists and funds that were investing in these kind of things. During COVID, when everybody stopped investing, we were looking for sort of one lead investor and then lots and lots of sort of friends, families, celebrities, family funds, that kind of thing. So it was definitely a different way of doing things during that time. We were fortunate enough to partner with a really great company who is still with us, who really pushed the first round of funding. Then it was a case of like, just, gosh, I mean, Adam can probably talk more on this because this was like his big thing, but we had all kinds of, not all kinds of people. I mean, we've still got some really great people that invested, but it wasn't like the second round of funding where one or two companies basically took the whole lot. It was, it was very different. I know now that there are certain funds who are looking to fund these kind of businesses exclusively in order to stop the the sort of equity dilution that occurs when you're spreading it this way. But in terms of hospitality and corporate hospitality, these kind of businesses are going to be dominant for next 10 to 15 years. So it does make sense right now.
Yeah, I know we had Manuel from the managing partner at DMG Ventures on, who I believe invested in F1 Arcade, and he was talking about this. This was maybe 6 months ago, which was interesting to hear his perspective. But last thing, I know we both got to jump. Future of social entertainment, where do you see it going? What's next? You said it's dominant next 10, 15 years. Why? And but what changes are coming? Because it feels like everyone's on to it now, and Top Golf isn't the only thing in town.
No, exactly. Look, I say it's dominant because there is now enough research and data to back up the fact that not just Gen Z, but Gen Alpha, like the whole sort of just drinking culture is no longer this thing that is a driver. Any sort of activity that can also go along with eating and drinking is like massively, massively pushed. It's pushed from a corporate side, like corporate companies want to be getting involved in these things. They like it for their staff. Families love doing it. Friendship groups love doing it. You also have an opportunity to elevate the food and drink that you do. It doesn't have to be what it might have been 20 years ago when you go to the bowling place where it's just Coke and hot dogs. You can be competitive in the sort of higher end casual dining market as well, because you have the space, you've got the audience, and you can go ahead and do that. Sorry, what was the other part of your question? I did have an answer, and then I've just let it drop out.
Yeah.
It's all right.
We were talking about why it's dominant and then the future of it, right? And that there's a bunch more concepts coming.
Yeah, for sure. So another thing is just so many landlords had all these like spaces that over time have just been retail dominant, and now the retail industry is taking such a massive hit across the globe. So landlords need to fill their spaces, and a business like ours or any of the other ones can come in and they can take two or three units and they can guarantee them a 10-year lease or a 15-year lease. And so there's more incentive for landlords to come in and kind of do and find these things as well. I think the future is that there's going to be a lot more of these concepts coming online. A few of them will probably not be the standards that we're used to, because when you do get into a market where people see the sort of potential and the opportunity, there becomes that sort of desire to do things quickly and to cut corners. For us, like our kind of average for getting something from concept to opening is about 3 years. Like there's a lot of work that goes into it. And the history the future of social entertainment, competitive socializing. Yeah, look, there's gonna be more and more. It's gonna be a lot more tech focused. There's gonna be a lot more stuff designed to motivate communities, especially around Gen Z communities and that kind of thing. And there's gonna be a lot of stuff that is brand expansive as well. It's not just about going to the physical space, doing your experience, and then that's it. There needs to be like a lot more touch points when you're not even in the space that you can do on the home, in the bus, anywhere else. Like brands really need to become, and they need to become omni-channel, like all of these kind of things. They're just going to just keep going and going. I think it will get to the point where there will be a concept for everything, really. There'll probably really, I don't know, maybe there'll be a sleeping bar where you can just book some beds for half an hour or something.
Yeah, a hotel. It'll just all go in a circle over time.
Yeah. Brand new hotels.
Yeah. Now, Ollie, I appreciate it. This was awesome. Super insightful. I'm excited to listen again myself. F1 Arcade, what's website, socials? Where can we learn more about yourself? I know you got a bunch of cool stuff going on. I'm sure you're still involved in some of the previous ones as well.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we actually when we started F1, we left our old company that we'd started to start a new company, because the potential with working with F1 was just so huge and we just needed that. So we are doing exclusively at the moment F1 Arcade. Our website is f1arcade.com, I don't think we've got a separate website for the US and UK. It's just different locations. All of our socials, TikTok and Insta, are F1 Arcade USA. And yeah, if you're interested in coming down, I mean, it's probably worthwhile pointing out that what we are is we have high-end racing sims where you can come and race F1 races, and you can eat really, really high-end food and really, really great drinks, cocktails, beers, wines, all that kind of stuff. But you don't need to be any good. You can be an absolute first-timer and be able to drive in one of our F1 cars. We've made it so that there's multiple skill levels, multiple ways to score points. So even if you are one of those people that thinks you're going to be bad at it, you will still sit in the car and come away with points at the end of your race. So yeah, nothing is ever lost, and it's fun. It's completely immersive. It's just fun. You can't not have fun doing it.
Yeah, I mean, while we're here, last one, it just came to mind. Of the business model, where do a lot of the margins come from? Is it the food and entertainment? Is it the actual activities, or what does that look like?
I think we're about 50-50 food, F&B, and activity. So, yeah.
Very cool.
In previous places, we've been sort of like, my silly hair, we've been maybe 75% F&B and 25% activity. But yeah, it's Putt Shack and F1 Arcade have definitely moved the needle.
Interesting. I love it. Well, awesome, brother. Congrats on Boston. Appreciate you coming on. And yeah, excited to get up to one myself here soon.
Yeah, for sure. Just let me know when you want to visit, and I'll sort it out for you.
Amazing.